Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world, on the internet, by webcast, and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Return of the Unexplained. And the return after a very long trip. I'm literally just back down from the northwest of England. I've been to a place near Liverpool, actually Formby, near Liverpool, if you know that area. And I've been involved in the clearance of my dad's house, which has been the most moving thing that I think I've ever gone through in my life, because there in that house is a chronicle of our family life. Many photographs of me, an awful lot of memorabilia from my early radio career, a lot of tapes and records and all kinds of stuff. And at the end of the day, I sat at the kitchen table, not 18 hours ago from when I'm recording this, and I had a conversation with my parents and hoped that they could hear it. And I recommend that if you're in a situation like this, maybe you try and do this too. I just told them how much I appreciated both of them and loved them and always would. And how much, looking at the story of my life chronicled there in that house, I will always be grateful to them for what they did for me. So that literally is what I've been involved in. Thank you very much for the amazing feedback to the Stephen Greer Show. We had the biggest demand, and I mean by country mile, for any show that we've ever done here. And I know that through that process, I've acquired many, many tens of thousands of new listeners, probably more than that, in the United States and Canada. Thank you very much, wherever in the world you are. And I've had emails from new listeners in all of those places. I'm really pleased to have you along. Spread the word about The Unexplained. This is how we get better. And this is how we get bigger. And I promise those two things to you. In fact, I make that promise at the beginning of every new year, and I hope that I deliver at the end of every year. I think we're going to deliver this year. I want to do big things with this show. I think the next thing we have to do, and thank you very much, by the way, for your donations. Please, they are vital to keep this work going. As I said, I ain't rich by any standard at all. In fact, money is always a problem, so to keep this little operation going, your donation's vital. But I think we're at the stage now where we maybe have to try and find a sympathetic sponsor. So if you have any ideas on that front, do drop me an email. The website is www.theunexplained.tv, www.theunexplained.tv, the website maintained manfully over this last week and over these years by Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool, www.theunexplained.tv. That's the place to go if you want to send me a message. Any thoughts about future guests? You've done a lot of that lately. Thank you. And also donations, a PayPal link there. But I take on board everything that you say. I did promise to do some shout-outs, so we're going to do that very, very quickly now. And this is by no means everybody who emailed. I have had hundreds of emails in this last week, and I have read them all, responded to many of them personally. But please know that when you send me an email, I get it. So hi to graphic designer Wayne Darnell in Maryland. Gino Greco, concerned about the UK's spy centre, GCHQ, allegedly mining our webcam images. I'm sure that somebody somewhere is doing that, and it ain't good. Heather Parker in Leeds, UK, fascinating email about precognition. Heather, thank you very much. Mark Verbeck, got results from the type of meditation recommended by Stephen Greer. It was a very popular guest. Not everybody agreed with everything he said, though, but by and large, you liked a lot what he said. Max Sanchez in Winnipeg, Canada, asking me to give a shout-out to Christy. Hello, Christy. And thank you very much. Apparently, you are the person, if I've got this right, who turned Max onto this show. So, Christy, thank you. Elaine Ballant, nice to hear from you. Roland Dent in the UK, telling me that he saw a USAF experimental aircraft over Britain in the 1960s. Really? Like to know more about that. Jean Dupont, who wants to translate one of my shows into French. Jean, can you get in touch and tell me more about that plan, please? Mike Regal in Colorado, two paranormal stories. I'm very keen to hear more. Thanks for that, Mike. Anthony Acree in Toronto, thought Dr. Greer hit it right on the money. That's what he said. That's a quote. Jason Francis wants me to interview Dick Larson in Los Angeles. Looking into that, Jason. Joe Hall wants me to get back, and I've been thinking about this. Isn't that weird? I wonder if that's universal consciousness. Major Ed Dames, the controversial remote viewer. Good call, Joe. I've been thinking about getting him back on, and maybe we should revisit Major Dames if he'll do it. Mick Robinson, good to hear from you. Ronan in Massachusetts, ditto. Sandra in America, who's been going through my back catalogue of shows and enjoying them. Thanks, Sandra. Slawomir Lenachinsky, thank you for your email. Bradley Surratt in Houston, Texas, says, consider David Talbot. I will, Bradley, thank you. And Dave Matthews in County Durham, who is now in Oslo, Norway. Good to hear from you, Dave. Spread of people around the world, thank you also to my Australian listeners and the people in New Zealand who've been emailing lately. If you want to get in touch, you know how to do it. Go to the website, www.theunexplained.tv. That is the place to make contact with me. Now, the show this time is something that has been organized very, very quickly, basically more or less since my return from Liverpool. A guy called Ola Damagard, he is, by the name, you can tell that, Scandinavian, but living in Spain, who got in touch with me, and he has been featured a great deal on American media and media in certain other places. He says that his researches that have gone on for many years bring him to the conclusion that there are very strong links between the assassinations of people like JFK, RFK, Olaf Palme, John Lennon, Che Guevara. He thinks these things are connected. Now, anybody who gets in touch with me and makes a suggestion like that is going to be considered to be on this show. And Ole Damagard, I'm going to check the pronunciation of his name in just a second, is going to be on seconds from now here on The Unexplained. So it's been a busy, busy week for me here in the UK, and quite an emotional one way or the other. And my feet are just kind of touching the ground here. I've got a cup of coffee, and we're going to connect with Ole Damagard in just a second from now. Please keep in touch with me. I'm so grateful for what you're saying. If you want me to improve this show, tell me how I can do it. If you have any thoughts on maybe a sympathetic commercial sponsor who could help me develop this, that would be great, because I am looking now. Or some other way that we can develop this show and make it sustainable, certainly with server capacity and that kind of stuff. I'll leave that thought with you. Let's cross now to Estepona in Spain and Ola Damagard. I think this is going to be an interesting show. Fingers crossed. Ola, thank you very much for coming on The Unexplained.
The pleasure is mine, Howard.
Now, you sound as if you're in some kind of subterranean vault, Ole. I think we better explain that you're in Spain, and I think you're in the Estepona area, if that's not giving away too much.
I am indeed. I live near Gibraltar, in the middle between Gibraltar and Marbella here, since the year 2000.
Which is a beautiful area to live in, I know. And you get pretty much a lot of sunshine, probably 300 days thereabout per year.
Yeah, that is true.
Does that ever become monotonous?
No, not at all. I would like 365 if it was up to me.
So would I. But your name gives it away, really, Ole Damagard. Which bit of Scandinavia is that from?
I was born in Denmark and moved to Sweden when I was a kid, and I grew up there. Since then, I've been living in the UK, Iceland, and now here in Spain.
Your biography, which I read before we did this, is long, detailed, and fascinating. Tell me a little snapshot of yourself up to this point.
I've been active in my life in many different areas. I really tried to do my utmost everywhere I've been involved, and I've been involved in anything from rock music to, I was in a rock band for 8 years. I was a journalist for quite a while. I've been working as an artist. I won awards for my paint arts, and I've done custom painting cars. I've done a lot, and also I've done quite a lot of traveling. I've been to many of these so-called strange countries like Iran and different war zones. During quite a few years, I was very attracted to war zones, and also I've been spending some 30 years of my life looking into conspiracies on a very high level, where this has been like, it's become almost like a quest for finding the truth.
And your website certainly gives full vent to that. It's a beautifully designed website, but then your design experience would allow you to do that. But it's well worth seeing. It's lightonconspiracies.com. We'll name check it again at the end as well, Ole. But it is a fascinating background, and I wonder why you were, what it is in you that is drawn towards war zones and controversy.
It's when I've been looking in my bookshelves. I mean, sometimes I've been wondering myself, and I've had It's almost like there's been two different eras. It's been the light and the dark. It's been spirituality or conspiracies. It's been different religions or it's been assassinations. It's been like very extreme. And I've never really understood it until the last few years when I suddenly started to see that it's not by coincidence that my website is called Light on Conspiracies. Because I think you need to be very strong spiritually to be able to dig into this darkness, because it is very, very dark around these different assassinations and so-called terror acts and so on. And most people get dragged down. But over the years, I've got enough, I managed to get enough stamina to be able to pull the way through. And this last year, I've been giving, I don't know how many interviews internationally, but it's like it's on a daily basis almost, because there's such an awakening going on at the moment where people from being very asleep and denying what's going on, the dark parts in the world, have now suddenly started waking up on a massive scale, which is incredible to be able to part of.
You say, Ollie, that there is this kind of global awakening, and I think I would agree with you on that score. Certainly if you look at the hundreds and hundreds of emails that I pick up here on The Unexplained regularly, a lot of those people are professional people. They are rational, intelligent people. A lot of them are our kind of age. And a lot of them are questioning the nature of news, for a start off. They don't believe that it's the truth. But also questioning the versions of events that we have been fed traditionally. Now, in previous generations, you want to go back to the 50s, 60s, whenever, people were much more accepting of what they're told. It now seems that people with greater education and with access to the internet and all the rest of it, they want to ask legitimate questions about the versions of events they are fed and told.
Yeah, true. And it's about time, high time, I would say, because we've been duped for so many years and been controlled in so many different ways that we have not been aware of. So it's really high time to wake up now, I would say.
Yep. You get no disagreement with me about that. I think where my listeners will take any guest who gets involved in the areas that you're getting involved in to task will be the specifics and the evidence of it. A lot of people come on and they've done secondhand research, they've read other people's books, or they just have a feeling that this may be the case and it may be so. And those kind of arguments don't cut it with my listeners, and they tell me. And because of my journalistic background, they less than cut it with me. So we're going to have to be a bit forensic about this. But I think having looked at your website, it's going to be worth doing it in this way.
I myself is not interested in theories at all. I only look for facts, 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 double checked, triple checked, and things that if I don't track it down myself, then from other people, and then double check it again and again and again, because there's so much misinformation being spread as well at the moment. The internet is an incredible tool of truth if it's used in the right way, but you need to be very aware of that. There's a lot that is being spread on purpose as disinformation to totally confuse and dilute the real truth.
All right, before we get stuck in, we just have to tell a funny story here. You're in a not ideal acoustic space, so I'll tell my listeners who are sensitive to those things or maybe have a broadcast background like I do. Your acoustic space is not ideal, so I've actually got you with a blanket over your head trying to dampen the acoustic there and reduce any reflections from the room. But if it sounds a little boxy, we've made a lot of effort, haven't we, Ole, to try and make this right.
I've gone undercover, actually.
With a blanket over your head. Absolutely. What I would say to any guest is the answer to a lot of these things, sometimes the digital connection can be absolutely flying, can be great. But if you get a headset, that will remove any problems to do with the room acoustic. But that's a future thing, and I want to do this conversation now. So, you were drawn to danger areas. What was it that hooked you into conspiracies particularly? And to do with assassinations and deaths?
I think when I grew up, like I said, I was born in Denmark, and my whole family was involved in the resistance movement against the German occupation during the Second World War. And like my dad was in the resistance movement. My granddad was in jail for helping Jews. My grandmother's sister used to smuggle weapons for the underground movement in baby cots and so on. And so I grew up with all these stories about how important it is to stand up for what is true and right, even though it might look very, very scary at times. And even though even though you're in a situation where it looks like David and Goliath, you still have to stand up for what is right. And I think I and my brother and sister have sort of like been, we were fed that into our genes when we grew up. And then, like I said, I used to work as a journalist. And in the early 1980s, I saw a documentary about the JFK assassination. In those days, this was not very, not a lot of people were aware of what actually had happened in those days. This was the first time I saw the so-called Zapruder film. The Zapruder film is a film that was filmed by a bystander filming the motorcade where JFK was traveling through Dealey Plaza, and it's filmed the whole sequence of the assassination itself, and it also very clearly shows that the final headshot that absolutely explodes the head of JFK comes from the front right, not from where the official story tells us that the shooter was, which was behind and to the right on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository.
And if you look at the film, it is pretty obvious. You have to be not looking, or you have to be biased in some way, not to see that the president's head shot backwards violently at that last time, and that was the shot that probably completely sealed his fate. And remote viewers like Major Ed Dames and other people, and people who've analysed the film and people who've done ballistics tests, have proved that there had to be a shot from within the car, or there had to be a shot there had to be a shot from somewhere ahead of the motorcade.
Yeah, front right was where the shot was fired. But What this started me, it got me into a situation where I just felt, my God, what we're being fed here, the official story is absolutely not true. I really need to find out what's going on here. So I started reading everything I could get hold of and all types of documentaries I could get hold of. And I think I read like a couple of hundred books on the JFK assassination. And while I did that, I also started with the Malcolm X and Martin Luther King assassination, Robert Kennedy assassination, and so on. And I came to a point where after a while it was very confusing for me, because sometimes in some books, for instance, one person was described as being working for the FBI. In another book, the same guy was working for the CIA. In a third book, he was a lieutenant in the Chicago mob. And in a fourth book, he was sometimes working extra for the Secret Service and so on. And I got very confused there for a while, until I came to the point where I understood they were actually true, all of them. All four versions were true. It was the same person. And this repeated quite a lot, that people working for the CIA was also sometimes connected and in bed with the mob. They were also very deeply involved with the FBI and so on. So it's one, the more I've studied it, the more of sort of like different sides of the same coin. A big mess where the CIA and the mob especially have been working so tightly together from the early 60s and all the way up until today.
And even the man who shot Lee Harvey Oswald, he had, he was misguided on all kinds of levels and may have been a patsy himself, may well have been a patsy himself, as a term used by Lee Harvey Oswald about his own role in things. He had involvement with the security services, didn't he?
No, he was involved with the Chicago mob mostly. But if you want to, we can go into the JFK assassination in great detail.
Well, I think the way to do this is to do exactly what we're doing, give an overview, and then we'll cherry pick some of these cases, and then we'll talk about how you believe they're all connected, because that is the difference between you and other people like Jesse Ventura and many, many other people who've been on this show talking about JFK, for one.
Yeah.
The difference between you and them is that you make connections between all of these things, and that is something that is not unique to you, but it's unusual.
I'm very aware of that, and I think the reason why it's, well, for once, it's taken me 30 years to come to this point, and it was like, the more I got into these different assassinations, it was after a while I started seeing almost like a template that they were using, following like a bullet point list exactly how to commit an assassination on a very high level.
The JFK assassination, then, you say that it follows a kind of template.
No, in the case of... What I'm saying is that once you start studying the different cases, you after a while, I started seeing like it was almost like a very clear pattern of how these things are committed, not exactly on a street level, on how the actual shooting is done or the killing, but the way the whole thing is set up beforehand, the whole setup with a patsy, with how the investigation is actually not a real investigation, but a cover-up mechanism, and how that is followed by different commissions afterwards to just cover up. And anyway, while I was learning more and more about these assassinations, the Swedish Prime Minister was shot down. It was actually on this very day, on the 28th of February, 1986. And at that point, I thought I was living in a country where you could trust the police, that they were the good guys, and they would do everything they could to catch the bad guys, and that there were no corruptions, and I lived in a perfect democracy, and so on. Unfortunately, that picture has changed quite a lot over the years since then. Because after a while there in Sweden as well, I started seeing that, my God, they're actually following the exact same template as the other assassinations. It's a massive, massive, massive conspiracy. I've been able to identify more or less everyone involved, the different, what they did, where the position, how it was financed, who drove the getaway cars, where they took the killer afterwards, how they were taken out of the country and so on, with local backup and involvement by Swedish police and the Swedish government and so on. But to this day, even though I've been offering this book, I've written this book, it's called Coup d'etat in slow motion. It's about 800 pages, very, very detailed about the assassination of Olof Palme, and also with all the connections to the other assassinations and to international illegal war, arms trading and drug trafficking and so on. It's a massive network that goes all over the world. But even though I've been approaching different TV stations, I've been giving the book for free to many of the different newspapers, I've been contacting Swedish radio station, even though I've been on I don't know how many international radio shows, not one single Swedish newspaper, radio station or TV station has been in contact with me ever. And I think this is very, very symbolic of this silence that is in Sweden. It's the official story or silence.
Well, Sweden is a very, having been there, it's a very safe country. It seems to me to be a country of conformity, because the quality of life is good. And who would want to rock that boat?
True. And I also feel that Sweden is being used as almost like a test area, just because, like you say, the Swedish population is very, they do not like conflicts. They bend away and, as long as they're fine and safe and so on, then it doesn't really matter. That sometimes people make jokes and say, if a Swede is really, really angry, he would put like a sticker in the rear window of his car. That's about it. Yeah. Whereas in other countries, you have a revolution on your hand. So this is where, when you look at what is going on, many of the new technologies that they try to impose on the rest of the world, it starts out in Sweden. They test it there, and if people are, there are no problems there, then they transfer it to the other countries as well.
When you say the new technologies, do you mean the new technologies of surveillance?
Surveillance, currency-free society, passports with microchips, these type of things, yes.
Okay. Well, I think the case of Olaf Palme is interesting. I remember reporting it on the radio when it happened because I'm that kind of age. And it isn't as much talked about as JFK, RFK, Princess Diana, etc. So let's talk about the Olaf Palme case, especially now as it is the anniversary that we're speaking on. And then we can start to tie it back to, say, JFK and see where the similarities are. Now, my memory of this man is that he was one of a long line of prime ministers in that country, very sober, very upright person, somebody who was not going to make waves in the international system. The last person you would expect to be bumped off, to be killed.
And this is not correct. He was a very controversial international politician.
Really?
Yeah, he was. He was the only one in the West who stood up against the United States in 1968, protesting against the Vietnam War. He was the first one doing that. He was the. He was standing up, and on quite a few occasions, the only one who dared to stand up against the U.S. He was also. The one who went first of all to visit Cuba. He went to Palestine with Yasser Arafat. He went to Nicaragua to see meet the Sandinist government. He was the first doing these things. He was also part of anti-nuclear different organizations trying to get a nuclear-free zone for Northern Europe or Scandinavia. And he was also the mediator in the Iran-Iraq war. And he was almost possible to become the new secretary for the UN. So he was not just an ordinary politician at all. Up until that point, Sweden was so non-violent. There was very little crime. There was very little violence. I mean, Sweden was proud that the Swedish prime minister was more or less always without bodyguards and all of these, you know, taking the bicycle to work or walking down the street between his the government building and his home and so on. But that changed very drastically after the killing of him. But with Olof Palme, it's a very tricky one because he... the more I've looked into him as a person, the more you see that this is a double-faced person. There was one, the official story, which was this kind man who was trying to do everything he could to look after the weak and the poor. That goes for other countries as well, like I said, with Palestine and Nicaragua and so on. But on the other hand, he was also a member of the so-called Bilderberg Group, which is part of the global elite. And he was also very much involved with the banking elite and going their errands big time. He was also involved in international arms dealing.
But let's be honest about it. You can say that about a whole raft of Western politicians, and it doesn't make them dark or sinister. It just makes them like all the rest.
I have not said black or sinister. I've said that this was what he was involved in. But so when it comes to the actual assassination, why he was killed, very, very tricky to answer because there were so many different interests that wanted to get rid of him. Quite a few saw him as being soft on communists, that he was going to Russia a month after his assassination. He was supposed to go to Russia and they quite a few people in Sweden, military people and so on, were afraid that he was selling out, that he was going soft on communism and that he was selling out Sweden and so on.
And let's just remind people what year this was, because this is an era when the Cold War was still on.
It was 1986, February 1986.
And there was no indication at that time that the Berlin Wall would come down and the communism would crash like it did. It was full on at the time.
It was full on, exactly. So, but then we have the official story and then we have what I've been able to find as far as I know is the truth. If we start with the official story, was that Olof Palme and his wife went to the cinema this evening. They were just having a nice evening out. And after the cinema, at around 11:15 in the evening, they started walking home towards their home in the old town of Stockholm. And on their way home, they passed a shop that was called Dekorima. And when they passed that, there was a man standing on the corner there, a man in dark clothes and so on. And when they passed, he just stepped forward up behind them and fired two shots, one in the back of Olof Palme that killed him more or less instantly, and another shot fired at his wife, Lisbeth Palme. After that, that one didn't hit her. Then after that, he ran away from this place into like an alleyway and then up some stairs up towards a street called David Borgares Gata. And from there, he disappeared. That's the last real observation of the shooter. And from then on, it's a mystery what actually happened there. To start with, there were a lot of different theories going on, that it could be the Kurdish movement, PKK, that had killed him. They got hold of one guy called the 33-year-old. His name was Viktor Gunnarsson. He was later murdered in the States. They tried quite a few different people to arrest or get for this assassination. And in the end, 2 years down the road, they got hold of an alcoholic, a local alcoholic guy called Christer Pettersson, who was from that day on the one that the society decided this is the guy. And he was taken to court, and Lisbeth Palme, the wife of Olof Palme, pointing him out in court, saying he's the guy who shot him.
But can I stop you there for just half a second, Ole? If this had been something similar to the JFK assassination, of course, the man who shot JFK, they said, was cornered pretty quickly. They had him, you know, within the day. You're talking here about a total dissimilarity where somebody eventually is found after 2 years. That doesn't sound like a patsy.
No, and this is why there's a radio station called Red Eyes Creations. I've given an 8-hour interview there in four different chapters, because this is extremely complex, not easy to describe quickly, because there are several different operations going on at the same time, and the original operation where there was a patsy involved that should be taken down that very evening, that failed. So this started a whole confusion afterwards, the whole thing that
right.
is...
So what we're saying is that the people who did this were not as efficient as the people who were experienced in doing these things in Dallas, Texas, and their plan worked, but it subsequently, of course, has been unpicked by all kinds of people using technology. But in Sweden, they weren't quite so lucky.
They were very skilled. The problem here was that there were two teams, and the first team was not aware of the second one. The second one was there to sabotage the whole thing, which they also did. So this is what has caused all this confusion and also dragged it out for years and years, because they wanted the official story, if you want to call it that. They had a patsy prepared, and they wanted him down, to take him down right away. Within a few hours. So that was the whole plan. But over the years, what I found that there's with these similarities with the JFK assassination and so on, is that none of the real witnesses have been taken seriously. They've been disregarded, they've been threatened, they haven't been heard. It's just the official story all the time. That is the one that has been taken seriously. And all the rest, they've just been neglected, or even people have been killed or beaten up and so on.
I wanted to ask you about that in other famous conspiracy theory deaths, if we want to call them that, people who've witnessed things or knew things, some of them have died in mysterious circumstances. So that happened in the Olof Palme case.
Yeah, there were journalists, police officers, witnesses, people who knew too much, people who were involved in the assassination itself and so on. In the book, I have a chapter, it's just called Strange Deaths. I mean, we're talking suicides, accidents, cancers, but you know, like the type of suicide where you stab yourself 15 times and then hit yourself in the face with a bat, and so on. And this is like, if you take the JFK assassination, I have a list of almost 300 people who have been cleared out. Part of this template they use is that they have like a cleanup team afterwards that clean up whistleblowers or take out witnesses or anyone who is becoming a threat to the official story.
And are we saying that it's the same bunch of people who wanted both JFK and Olof Palme dead because they were threats to the established way of things?
I would say that there are different reasons why they took out JFK and Olof Palme. With JFK, it would be good, I think, at this point, if we keep them separated, because they're quite complex. But you're talking about the connections between these different assassinations. If you want to, I can go into details about how they're connected.
So let's talk about those similarities. Let's unpick them.
Okay. What I've been able to find over all of these years is in the late 1950s, early 1960s, President Dwight Eisenhower gave his vice president, Richard Nixon, the task of putting together a team of highly skilled assassins that could be used to take out foreign leaders or whoever they had problems with, domestic or abroad. The guy that Richard Nixon was working together with to do this was a man by the name of Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles was the creator of the OSS. He was part of Operation Paperclip, where they exported all the thousands of Nazis out of Nazi Germany into America and countries in South America and so on. But also the director of the CIA at that time. So Richard Nixon, what they did was that the first target they had was Fidel Castro. They had a big problem with this bearded guy. So what they did was in Miami, they recruited quite a lot of exiled Cubans that had escaped from Cuba to Miami. They recruited them. They were former military people from the Air Force, former police officers and so on. Brutal people, but highly skilled assassins. This came under the name of a group called Operation 40. Now, this Operation 40, they started out with 40 members, but within a year they were up to 86. It was mostly exiled Cubans, like I said, and then with people from the CIA. The CIA was sort of the lieutenants of the group, and the people from the CIA were Ted Shackley, who was later extremely high up in the CIA and involved in hundreds and hundreds of assassinations globally. Then another man was E. Howard Hunt, who later became famous because he was part of the...
Well, he was one of the Watergate conspiracies, yeah.
Exactly. He was also deeply involved in the JFK assassination. And then another person was David Attlee Phillips. Now, David Attlee Phillips was actually later, he got all the way up in the top of the CIA as director for covert operation for the Western Hemisphere, the whole Western Hemisphere of the world. But at the time, in the early 60s, and at the time of the JFK killing, he was actually the so-called controller of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was also the controller of the one that fired the final headshot, a man by the name of James Files, who was also very closely connected to Operation 40. And he was also the controller of a man called Michael Vernon Townley, who many years later were part of killing Olof Palme in Sweden. Anyway, this group, Operation 40, like I say, it consisted, they were trained in Louisiana, they were trained in Miami, and also in Guatemala in different camps, in everything from guerrilla warfare to shooting bazookas, explosive poisons, all of these type of things. And they were used, they tried to get rid of Fidel Castro quite a few times, but then and failed. They also were part of taking out there was an attempt on the president of the Dominican Republic. But then when this group, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when suddenly JFK became a major threat to the whole military-industrial complex, and it was, like I say, it was during the Cuban Missile Crisis, it came to a point where Kennedy was almost forced to push the button that could have started the Third World War, like a nuclear war against Russia. And people who were there in the room said that JFK sat there almost with tears in his eyes, with the militaries around him saying, just push it, push it, push it. And he said, I refuse to be the one who does this to the world. After that point, it's almost like he had like a revelation or a change of personality from being quite an easy president to manipulate. He suddenly became this very, very strong individual who said, I'm going to withdraw out of Vietnam, a war that hadn't even really started from the American point of view. They only had like 16,000 advisors there at the time. I'm going to crush the CIA into 1,000 pieces. I'm going to take away all the power from the CIA and give it to the military. I'm going to withdraw from the Federal Bank Reserve, get out of the grip of this very criminal bank coalition or cartel. And there were many different reasons why JFK, they wanted to get rid of him, but these were just a few of them. So what they did was they turned this cannon called Operation 40, this super secret team that was also part of an operation called Mongoose, and they turned it towards and aimed it at Kennedy instead. So when you look at Dealey Plaza this day, when researchers say that it was the mob that was behind the killing, or it was the CIA that was behind, or it's the exiled Cubans or the Secret Service, they are all right. It was, in my opinion, an illegal legal coalition between a liaison between them, an unholy alliance between these things.
Well, literally a cabal, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And so what they did was everyone involved, the mobsters that was part was Sam Giancana from Chicago. You had Meyer Lansky, you had Santos Traficante from Miami, and you had Carlos Marcelo from New Orleans. Like that was the mob thing, because at this time JFK also, even though the mob to some extent had helped him come to power through Sam Giancana, he turned against them and put his brother Robert Kennedy to start like a witch hunt, tracking down mobsters all over the place and sensing that getting them to jail. So they were very, very threatened at this point. Also, Lyndon Johnson, the vice president of Kennedy, he was facing prison time because he had been involved in a lot of illegal activities, including 7 different murders. One of them.
And we went over a lot of this ground recently with Jesse Ventura on the anniversary. Of course, Lyndon Baines Johnson, a man whose hands were not entirely clean, as history is starting to show now, and that is another part of this mix. So there we have a Stop Kennedy coalition. He was in a lot of people's crosshairs. If you put those people together, then you get a plot.
Exactly. And so this JFK assassination has been used as an example for secret military operations in the States and so on, of a perfect way to carry out an assassination. It was a school example, and it was called the grandmother of conspiracies. But what they did was that everyone who was involved in this had to deliver shooters as well. It was almost like when Julius Caesar was murdered, they wanted everybody to stab Caesar so that everybody dipped their hands in blood, so nobody could point accusingly at the other ones.
And everybody's implicated, everybody's guilty, and everybody has to keep shtum.
There you go. That's the key word. So this day, all of them supplied shooters. And if you want, I can go through the shooters, and then afterwards we can see where they fit in other conspiracies as well.
Let's do that. Yeah, if there's a brief way to do that, please.
Oh, brief way. Okay, I can only say that one major figure in many, many, many of these conspiracies and wars globally is George Bush Sr. He pops up everywhere once you start digging into these things again and again. And he was also, as a young man, put there to take care of the finances for Operation 40. This was in very early 1961 or something like that. He was the guy who funneled the money from the oil tycoons in Texas, from the military industrial complex, from the mob and so on, into Operation 40. So, and one of his, the man that he was given to help him with this task was an exiled Cuban by the name of Felix Rodriguez. Now, Felix Rodriguez became very famous later because he was deeply involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. You're going to see that this Operation 40, the members there, they pop up in Dealey Plaza, Robert Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King assassination, the Iran-Contra scandal. They were the ones who tracked down and killed Che Guevara in Bolivia. They were there when Salvador Allende was overtaken and murdered so the Pinochet regime could take over. They were very deeply part in the Operation Condor after the overtaken Chile, where they tracked down supporters of Allende. They were part of blowing up Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C., Embassy Row there with a car bomb. They were part of killing General Carlos Prats. And it just goes on and on. And these members also were part of killing John Lennon, I can go into that, and Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan was not a very obvious murder, but I can go into details explaining how that was done.
Hold on, Bob Dylan is still with us.
No, sorry, Bob Marley. I'm sorry about that. Thank you for correcting me.
But, you know, Bob Dylan has upset a few people over the years, but I'm pleased to say that he's still here. But Bob Marley, sadly, is not here.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're talking about the A-team of hit mobs, the people who are, they take this to a whole other level. This is not just a dirty little hit organization. These are a bunch of professionals who get the job done.
They do. They are very, very efficient, and they've been active all the way up until today. I mean, now quite a few of them are old guys, but and some of them have died very violently, but some of them are still very active to this very day.
Okay, I get the fact, and I buy very much into the idea that there might be such an organization, a bunch of people who do these things. There are too many so-called coincidences not to believe that there might be something like this going on. Where I find it difficult and the clouds start to form for me is the idea that there is a common aim. That's a lot of disparate people, John Lennon, Bob Marley, RFK, JFK, Olof Palme. What common aim can there be to take those people out?
The common aim is that they stand for peace. They stand to unify mankind, and they stand for good. The cabal we're talking about, who are behind this, their agenda is death and destruction, war, oil, drugs. This is their agenda, making billions out of death, killing other people. And the problem where many beautiful people have been taken out is that they have been standing out saying, stop it. It's time to stop the madness. Let's move forward in love and compassion, and let's build this up into a beautiful world. Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, JFK as well, and Lady Diana. The reason, in my opinion, she was taken out was because she was standing up very strongly against landmines, which is crucial for the global elite's agenda when it comes to invading new countries and so on. So, and also the same with John Lennon and Bob Marley. They stood for peace.
We have a case here in the UK that has come to light again in the papers recently. A British BBC television newscaster, I'm not sure if you're aware of her, Jill Dando, who was shot in the head to death on her doorstep in Gowan Avenue, Fulham, it comes to my mind again, at the back end of the 1990s, and they never really got to the bottom of that entirely as to who was behind that. And in the papers this week, there's been some kind of Serbian connection because she made some kind of television appeal, but nobody's really known. It was a very strange case, and it was literally something that had all the hallmarks of an execution.
Well, I don't know about this case, but I would not be surprised at all. Like I said, there's so many deaths surrounding these assassinations and different terror acts, so-called terror acts.
So from what you're saying, and through my life, and we're a similar kind of age, aren't we, Ole? It has often seemed that somebody who seems to be good and somebody who seems to be standing up for peace and somebody who seems to be making waves and rocking boats. You almost know as if it's some kind of awful movie drama that one of these days people like that tend to get a bullet in them, or they get blown up, or they die in mysterious circumstances. It's just become, not exactly a rule, but it's something that happens fairly often.
It does, and this is why, like I say, I don't know if I mentioned, but I had two friends in Sweden who was murdered or died in very strange circumstances surrounding our investigation into the Olof Palme assassination. I also left Sweden because I felt threatened there, and I mean, this is not a play. It's not a game. You know, it's really dangerous. It's like a minefield where you don't know if you stepped on a mine before it's too late. You know, it's like it is. Truth is what they fear.
But my listeners would email me, and they will email me, to say something that I may have a little sympathy with, and that is that if you put together a series of cases, you can always find, if you look for them, commonalities. And maybe that's all you've done. You've just found commonalities between completely separate and unconnected cases. What do you say to that?
I say let me go into some details, and then we can discuss afterwards.
All right, well, if somebody put that point to you, maybe one of my listeners might email you through your website, which they can do, and we'll give the details at the end of this, and put that point to you. What's the killer argument that you would make to them?
Look at the evidence. Let me go into details. I'll describe you what happened in Dealey Plaza. I'll describe what happened in the Ambassador Hotel in when Robert Kennedy was killed. And I'll show you the same people were actually part of killing Olof Palme as well.
December the 9th, 1980, is a date that is burned into my consciousness very, very much. I will never forget the day that I woke up to discover via Radio City in Liverpool, his home station, that John Lennon had been shot outside the Dakota Building in New York City. I've been to that spot, I've been to Strawberry Fields, and I still can't believe that John is not here. He was a great force for peace. Talk to me a little bit about that case.
Okay. Just like we said, John Lennon is one of these people as well that when he said something, the rest of the world listened. This was his problem, you know, because it's one thing if you're Mr. Nobody and just talks and nobody listens. But somebody like that, or Diana or something, when they say things like that, like stand up for peace, give peace a chance, something, people really, millions are listening. And he was just about to make his comeback this time with Yoko Ono. And at the time when he was shot, they were when they came from the studio in a limo. They came to the Dakota Building, and the official story says that Mark Chapman, the guy that has been accused for shooting him, he was standing to the right. He had been standing there waiting for him all day long, more or less. And first Yoko Ono left the car, started walking through the entrance in towards the Dakota Building, and John followed like 5-6 meters behind her. When he was just a few steps from the car, these shots were fired. There was 5 or 6 shots fired at least. And John fell down, started crawling towards the building, and Yoko came out, and there was an awful, awful thing. And the official story says that the doorman ran over and grabbed the gun from Mark Chapman, took the gun and said, "My God, do you know what you just did? You just killed Lennon." From that point, Mark Chapman was just standing like a zombie, doing absolutely nothing, just waiting for the police to come, pick him up. And from then on, he has been the one that has been sentenced and put in jail for this assassination.
And of course, he makes repeated attempts almost every year or so to try and get parole, to try and be let out. And he keeps, quite rightly, in my view, being refused that.
Yeah. So if you look at the crime scene, which is, I always use what I call a Farmer Brown logic, you know, just like you said with a final headshot from JFK, if his head is thrown violently backwards and to the left, that means that the bullet comes from the front right, not from the back right. It doesn't make sense. And like, for me, I just go for you know, like 1 + 1 = 2. Doesn't matter if you got a fancy robe and a fancy title. If you tell me it's 34, I know it is not true, that you are lying for some kind of reason. And so when I come to a crime scene, I always try to just study the evidence. What happened? What actually occurred? And when you see the John Lennon assassination, Mark Chapman was officially standing to the right. All shots fired at John hit him straight from the left, and some of them so tight together that the coroner could have problems seeing if it was more than one shot. So who was standing to the left would be a good question. Now, this doorman who ran over and took the gun officially, his name was José Perdomo. And José Perdomo, he disappeared after this assassination. You only hear about him as the doorman. Nowadays, it's coming out more and more. But this José Perdomo, for 10 years, he was one of the highest ranking officers in Operation 40.
I'd never heard that before. I don't
I
know where
know.
I've been, but I've never heard that before. How do you know that?
No, because this is what part of these 30 years. With John Lennon, his name, José Perdomo, was mentioned just with the first few, like 30 minutes after the assassination. And had I not known about Operation 40, it would have just passed. And from then on, José Perdomo, suddenly he's just mentioned as the doorman, and then he just disappears from all the official.
To the best of your knowledge, I know it's 30 odd years now, but where is he?
I don't know. I have absolutely no idea what happened to him after this assassination. Frank Sturgis, who was also one of the Watergate burglars and who were in Operation 40, who was also in Dealey Plaza, he claims that José Perdomo died in 1974. But I mean, this is a man who's been lying his teeth out, covering up a lot of these different actions he's been involved in. What happened afterwards, I have no idea. I mean, very often these assassins, if they do a hit on that level, they're taking out themselves within a very short time.
In the JFK case, the autopsy was, we've later come to see, highly suspect. In the John Lennon case, well, I remember it all very, very well. It all seemed to me to be over very quickly.
That is standard procedure as well in these cases. You know, get the thing buried. Put the lid on as soon as possible,
And the
and
fact of
then.
the matter is, in the Lennon case and the JFK case, and probably all of these cases, there is a cloak of public shock there which can allow, I think, and this is only what I surmise, that can allow facts to sneak under the radar.
Yeah, they do that on purpose. Also, I would say that the. You know, somebody like JFK, they could very easily, or Olof Palme, they could have very easily just slipped a pill in his coffee if they just wanted to get rid of him. That wouldn't have been a problem. But they wanted to statue an example from time to time. You know, they just, it's like a power, how should I say, demonstration, just saying, making a massive impact, saying, we can get anyone, anywhere, at any time. So whoever thinks about becoming a whistleblower or do anything out of line, you just better shut up and back in line.
And how does that make you feel? Because a lot of people who've had controversial views, like yours, that I've spoken to on here, they sometimes feel that their publicity, the fact that they're in the glare of publicity, that they do interviews, that they write books, and that they're seen, is a kind of protection. Do you feel that way, that the more that you appear in the public arena, the more that you speak about this, the less of a target you can be? Because if anything happened to you, it would be very, very plain and obvious.
Exactly. This is there are two ways to go when you do the things that I do, and either you go under the radar, you know, which I did for 25 odd years. I've been tracking down secret agents. I've been meeting a lot of the people involved in the Olof Palme assassination. I've been very close to people that were involved and so on, and without them really noticing me. You know, I've been interviewing a lot of people without them really understanding who I was, you know, because I felt that, like I said, there are two ways. Either you get the spotlight big time on you, or you need to go very, very low and very carefully if you really want to make a deep inquiry into these type of things.
So that's why, until you got in touch with me and I checked you out and looked at some of your interviews and looked at your website, I hadn't really heard anything about you. You've been quietly working away at this. You've been making the connections over all of these years, and now you're in a position to ascend to a higher public profile.
This is exactly it. I was totally quiet until December last year. And it came to a point where, like I said, I'd written this book called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. And it came to a point where I tried to get it published over the years, very carefully picking the right publisher, which is not easy because this type of information is not easily published either. So I tried, I did not succeed in it anyway. And then it came to a point where I felt I have a lot of this knowledge is only on my shoulders here. It would be a lot better if it's out there. You know, the more that know about it, the better it is, and the safer I am as well. Because, like I said, the problem with this for this group is the truth. That's the only thing they fear, is it's the truth. So what I did was in December last year, I decided to set up, I made this website, and I set up like a little network internationally. And I said, please, I'm going to send you this book. And if you could please just spread it out to as many as possible within the next hour, that would be excellent. So we said, go, and poof. And within the next few hours, this book was out there in the thousands all over the world, which made me feel a lot more, I could breathe out, and I felt really good about that.
Because you have come from nowhere, really, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you emailed me, and yeah, Now I know more about you. My first thought was, this guy's got to be a hoaxer. That was my first thought.
Well, fine with me.
And you're going to get people who say that, you know, this is just, it's either a hoax or you're deluded.
Well, fine with me. It's like, I'm not here to persuade anyone. I'm here to share information that could be of use to enlighten this whole situation.
And what use is it for, say, the family of Olof Palme on this sad anniversary, 28 years ago today, this man was killed? What good is it going to do for the world and for this man's family and anybody who may have known him to know these things?
It is a national trauma. If we go to the Olof Palme assassination, it's a national trauma. There are two traumas in Sweden. It's the Estonia, the sinking of the ferry Estonia, which killed almost 1,000 people, and it's the murder of Olof Palme. And these two are I don't know what, but until they're solved, it is a trauma. It really is a trauma. And I believe that whatever the problem is, almost the solution is always the truth. The truth is the healer. And so because a lot of people have suffered, a lot of innocent people have suffered, a lot of innocent people have got their careers destroyed, their names destroyed, and so on, in the wakes around these assassinations, especially like the Olof Palme, for instance. There's quite a few high-ranking people that have been standing up, talking, speaking out, and been totally demolished.
And you said that you had two friends connected with this who died. How much can you tell me about them?
It was two dear friends of mine we were a small group of people in Stockholm. I moved to Stockholm after the assassination to be as close as possible to try and find out what had happened there, because this absolute mystery. And so I moved to Stockholm. I got a job as a bus driver and just worked during the days and in the evenings and nights and weekends. I was trying to get in touch with as many witnesses as possible, and the more I get to know as much as possible from people who had studied this for a long time. So these two people that died were people in this small group of so-called private investigators. And one of them ended up in the subway with his skull smashed in. Officially, it was an accident, but nobody had seen what happened. And his autopsy protocol, it took us 8 months to be able to get it published. And once you start reading it, you will see that it describes exactly like he had got his head somebody hit him in the head with something very hard, instead of the way you would describe if he had fallen in the stairs and so on. And the other guy, he was, I would say, almost like the leader of this group. He was the guy who, the center of all of this, the guy who managed to gather big meetings and so on. But he was becoming too big-headed and too careless, and he ended up dead as well. So it was very, very tragic, I would say.
You and I could talk for hours. Unfortunately, you know, the duration of these shows is strictly limited because of bandwidth and all sorts of other boring stuff. If we were to summarise what you're saying and be fair to you, then we're coming to the conclusion that you say there is an international cabal that's been going for decades, is still going right now. Its interests are in making money, its interests are in fostering instability, and anybody who speaks out against that and talks peace and talks order better watch out for a bullet or some kind of calamity. Is that fair?
If you push it, if you keep pushing it, I would say yes, that is fair to say. And
without naming names, are there people in this world now, and I, for obvious reasons, we don't want to name living people right now, who you think are at risk?
Yes, I mean, everyone who really pushes it are at risk, yes. There are people like Professor Jim Fetzer in the States, who is very much and deeply involved in
Well, yeah, but there are lots of people who are involved in investigating 9/11, and you know, some of them have told me that they are a little concerned that there is interest in them. But I'd rather not, you know, kind of go into detail about names here. But you're saying that in 2014, this kind of thing could happen.
Yeah.
That's very, very scary.
Yeah.
What can we do about it?
We can do what we're doing. I mean, if people are interested, like on my website, there's been like a tidal wave of interest the last 12, 15 months. And I've done countless interviews where I've gone into great details, where I've named names, the exact connections, how these things were carried out, proof like this. And I feel, for one thing, I feel at risk sometimes, and I know everyone else that really pushes it have, I would say that they should be aware of what they're up against.
Okay, if people want to know about you and your work, let's give details of that website.
It's called lightonconspiracies.com, and my book is called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. I've got other books as well. But this is the one describing the whole, it focuses mainly on the Olof Palme assassination, but then it goes into also the whole international network around these illegal arms tradings and also assassinations like JFK and the Estonia, the sinking of MS Estonia and so on.
Just out of interest, and I want to talk to you about other cases on a future occasion. We have to talk. And if you come to London, we can do this in person. I would very much enjoy that. It is a difficult position that you're in, though, because you are making claims that some people may find outrageous. And if what you're saying is to be believed, then you're putting yourself at a certain amount of risk. Have you ever felt that what you're doing is not worth it and that you want to just go and enjoy the sunshine in Spain?
Many times, many times. I mean, this is not sort of a pleasant trip, not at all. And many times, I don't really know why I've chosen this this task, but I feel this is one of the reasons I'm alive, is to be part of exposing what is going on. And I am absolutely not happy putting myself at risk with these things. But I feel it's necessary to do it, and if no one else do it, then I will do it. And hopefully, I really, really hope from the bottom of my heart that this will lead to good things, because I'm absolutely, totally against violence, totally against hate, totally against revenge. I'm only there to be part of exposing the truth. It's almost like if you look at a body, a beautiful body, and it's got like a cancer growth, that you need to expose this cancer growth. You need to open it up, even though it's really painful and it can be smelly and scary. But only by exposing it can the body then, after start healing itself.
It seems to me that what you need, and we've only got seconds to go really, Holly, which is a shame, but what you need, the support of somebody or a number of people famous and influential. Have you had phone calls from people who maybe haven't wanted to give their name or have given their name on condition that you keep it secret? You know, important people who've said you're on the money here? Anybody backed you up?
I'm in the process of being backed up at the moment, but I sure could do some help because it's very hard to do this kind of research for so many years with a family.
And you say you're in the process of being backed up. Has somebody come forward and agreed to support you in your work?
I promise not to talk about this, but indirectly, yes.
All right. Well, let's park it there. Fascinating. Olly Dabbergood, we've only scratched the surface. I'm grateful to you. We have to talk again. And if you come to the UK, get in touch. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Howard. And like I said, anything I can do to help spread the truth, I'm right there. Whatever it takes, I'm right there.
Well, like I said in the conversation, the first reaction I had when Olly Dabbergood got in touch with me is this guy's got to be a hoaxer. And the more I read about him, I thought, I don't think so. And that's why I put him on this show, and that's why we turned this show round so quickly on this anniversary of the killing of Olof Palme, something that I won't forget, 28 years ago. I think we have to talk with him again. Tell me what you thought about Olly Dabbergood. You can get in touch with me, send me an email through the website www.theunexplained.tv. www.theunexplained.tv. That's the website designed, created and maintained by the great Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. Thank you very much for your support. If you can make a donation to the show to help it to grow, because I want it to grow, I want to be doing more of these shows more often and in more places. And I can only do that with your help. You can leave a donation at the website where there is a PayPal link. www.theunexplained.tv. Thank you very much for your wonderful supportive emails. Keep them coming. I see them all. And until next we meet, stay calm, stay safe, and stay in touch. My name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained, and I'll see you again soon. Take care.